This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists worry that oxygen will become depleted in the oceans due to global warming. One organizer of the upcoming Royal Society meeting on that topic is the American expert Peter Brewer. When it comes to ocean chemistry, Dr. Peter G. Brewer has been a leader for a long time. During his 24 years at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, his period at the National Science Foundation, and now his research position at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, Peter Brewer has published over 170 scientific papers and edited several books. He's been out on countless research ships and more recently is connecting with scientists in China. Peter's latest commentary, published in the AGU Journal of Geophysical Research, is dead on for our program today. It's titled Ocean Chemistry, Ocean Warming, and Emerging Hypoxia. Hypoxia means reduced oxygen. But I'm hoping we'll also find a couple of minutes for his earlier research into ocean acidification and the emergence of methane from the Arctic. Dr. Brewer joins us from the Monterey Bay, California. Peter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, good morning to you.
I'll begin with the same question, if I may, that I asked your co-organizer, John Shepherd. Why is the Royal Society hosting this special conference of scientists about loss of oxygen in the seas?
Well, it's very timely, and we like to tackle puzzles, and we look at things that are understood in science, which things are not. And John Shepherd and I became pretty well convinced that this was a terribly unexplored problem that was ripe for solutions, so we'd like to put it to rights.
Can you recall when you first became aware of this problem?
Well, it was quite a while ago. I served on the IPCC panels, you know, the intergovernmental body that writes reports on climate change. And I began to be concerned as I looked at the chapter we were writing that I didn't think it was correct. So I voiced this concern to my colleagues and was basically told, you know, that this is not the place for original research. This is an assessment. And so if there's 20 scientific papers out there all saying the same thing, that's what we report. If you think they're wrong, then go away and write a research paper and come back and it'll be reviewed next time around. And that was probably staying within the rules, so we did so. And I tried to put it into my mind, well, what am I concerned about? What specifically do I think is misrepresented or not well represented at the moment? And after thinking it through, I worked it out. The concept is very simple. If every household has a refrigerator, if I look at mine, the manufacturer's recommendation is it should run at, I think, 37 degrees Fahrenheit. If your refrigerator was suddenly to run at 43 degrees Fahrenheit, you'd worry, your cheese would go off faster, you'd call tech support and so on. And that's what's happening to the ocean. It will get warmer, and so microbes will grow faster, things will break down faster. The trouble is that wasn't represented in the equations. It's very simple, but the fact that it's not been there is worrisome.
Well, is this oxygen loss from climate change, and I'm not talking about runoff from fertilizers, but climate change itself, is that a distant threat, or are there signs that it is already happening?
Oh, it's happening very strongly. Yes, plenty of signs. And the numbers look a little bit large, and that's what's got us concerned. And also, there are three main drivers for it. The simplest one is that warm water just dissolves less oxygen from the air. So if the ocean warms by 2 degrees Celsius, which it is going to do, then the oxygen solubility is lowered by about 14 micromoles per kilogram. And there's already plenty of parts of the ocean, in fact, right here off California, outside my office, where down around, 600 meters depth, there's already less oxygen than that. So we would go to zero there and have a true dead zone, not a talking point dead zone, but a dead zone with no oxygen, just from solubility. But that seems to be the smaller effect. When we look at the trends that are being observed in the ocean, then the solubility term accounts for about 15% of what we're seeing. About 85% is due to other causes. And people have been a little shy about describing why that is. On the physical side, the belief is that it's mostly due to what's called stratification. The surface of the ocean gets warmer, it's more stable, winter storms aren't as intense, the ocean doesn't take as deep a breath as it used to, less oxygen getting down there, and that's the big driver. On the chemical side, we point to the very classic reaction I just described. We use the laws of Van 't Hoff and Arrhenius written down in the late 1800s. And you see it every day. If, you know, the milk spoils, if you leave it out too long, things get warmer. And that effect seems to be large, too. The worrisome part is that those three things seem to add together.
And I recall about 10 years ago, British scientist James Lovelock warned about ocean stratification and the risk to living systems, and he proposed installing a network of giant pipes to get the water moving. Are we talking about the same problem?
Well, stratification is the same problem. I don't think there's any way on this earth we could tackle it with giant pipes. Those are engaging ideas which make people think, you know, they stimulate the mind. But they're not in any way a practical solution in terms of cost or scale or volumes of water that can be moved. So these are mind games we play to stimulate ideas, but they're not practical.
Now, the Monterey Bay Aquarium and its research institute are famous for the study of sea life. What types of marine life would likely be the first victims of a change of oxygen in the seas?
Well, that's a very broad question. The specific thing we are looking at here is what happens when oxygen levels get very, very low. And then we get a set of consequences. Microbes start to do nasty things. But oxygen in general is a driver for a very large number of species, like salmon, for instance, like cold, well-oxygenated water. If it's warmer and a little bit less oxygen, they wouldn't like it. That's at the upper end of the scale. So it's likely that declining oxygen levels will cut across a very wide swath of things for marine life. It's tied in with temperature, too. They don't operate independently. And so that as temperature changes, a whole body of other chemical and physical transport processes change, too. So we're dealing with multidimensional space. But everywhere we look, it's going to be harder for animals to respire in the subsurface ocean. Its oxygen levels will go down a bit, and it will be a bit tougher. And we're going to start to squash marine life into a narrower band.
Now, something you said stimulated a worry that developed as I read your new paper and other papers on this topic, and that is that perhaps we won't see so much the dead zones, which do make headlines, as a general weakening of life in the sea, which will be harder to pinpoint, but could indeed come from this lack of oxygen.
Yes, you know, the combination of temperature and oxygen, together with ocean acidification, which will be mixed in with it, overall is not going to be good. And the problem is to try and see this with clarity. So we've identified a couple of key problems which can be crystal clear. These effects happen. And that's just the opening round. We'll be debating it at the Royal Society meeting, and I'm sure it will lead on to a whole bunch of other questions. I read a fascinating paper the other day pointing out that as we get ocean warming, we get a poleward migration of marine species. And some of them, of course, have got microbes in we don't like. And so you can start to track the northward progression of human diseases related to fish consumption because the fish are eating different things or the species that carry these microbes are migrating. There can be a cascade of effects, and we're just scraping the surface here.
I hadn't even considered that. We have seen some tropical fish showing up in the northern islands of British Columbia, but yes, they're going to have some microorganisms along with them.
Yes, and fisheries-related problems will start to crop up. Right now I'm looking at more glaring problems. If we can only account for 15% of the observed changes, what's driving the 85%? That would mean it could be six times bigger than what we're seeing so far. How large are these effects going to be, and how well can we simulate them? And if we just do the physics alone, we're not likely to get it. If we just do the chemistry alone, we're not likely to get it. We've got to find a way to put those two together.
And if you'll pardon a stupid question, but if we're going to lose oxygen from the sea, I'm assuming there's a relatively constant amount of oxygen on the Earth. Where does it go?
Well, the upper ocean, where phytoplankton grow, continues to grow. The upper ocean will be green. It will produce oxygen just as we go on now. You won't see any effect really in the atmosphere. But as those cells fall down and die and are consumed in the deep sea, those microbially driven chemical reactions will go faster. And so the familiar oxygen minimum zones, which are down a few hundred meters, will grow more intense. Particles falling down through the sea will be consumed by microbes a little bit faster, just like your refrigerator would rot things faster if it warmed up. And we'll start to see the areas of the ocean which are acutely low in oxygen start to expand their range and sneak upwards in the water column. That'll help to compress life zones. Many, many animals can't tolerate very low oxygen levels, and we're talking we can go to zero. It's going to be a mess.
Before we get back to that, I'm wondering if we could take a short detour into work you published in 2013. It was in the journal Nature Geoscience, and the title is Marine Biochemistry, Arctic Shelf Methane Sounds Alarm. Dr. Brewer, what did you find out about Arctic methane, and how alarmed should we be?
I think that's interesting, but nowhere near the problem we're discussing here with oxygen. As I recall, the editors at Nature asked me to write a commentary on some observations from a Russian and U.S. team finding huge numbers of gas vents on the floor of the Arctic Ocean. They use their sonar, they detect these plumes, they're huge, they're on the Russian shelf, and of course they want to sound the alarm about that. I had to be a little cautious. There's nothing that suggests those vents weren't there decades earlier. We don't know how soon they started. Most of that methane is consumed within the ocean. Rather little gets out to the atmosphere. So there's just a few unknowns there. So it's a fascinating story. But in terms of a global threat, it's nowhere near the threat that we're going to get from oxygen losses in the ocean. I put in an aside in that review, which I thought was worrisome. The original paper that I was commenting on was dedicated to the lives of Russian sailors that were lost rescuing the science party. The rescue ship had set off and was hit by a nasty storm and sank. And, of course, it is quite possible that that storm would not have occurred and been that severe if there had been ice cover at that time of year, which there would have been a century ago. And there isn't now. We're losing ice in the Arctic. It's showing up, it's storminess, it changes. There's a whole cascade of human effects involved.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest today is one of America's top oceanographers, Dr. Peter G. Brewer, and we've reached him at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in California. So, returning to your latest paper, Peter, this April, I see it's really your second plea to get oceanographers to change methods now that oceans are warming. What has been the problem with previous methods?
Oh, I would have to confess, I think we've all been a bit lazy. About 50 years ago, people started to write out equations describing how oxygen consumption occurred in the ocean. And they said, well, it might be temperature, it might be the amount of organic matter, it looks like it's related to depth, got to do something. So let's write it out as a logarithmic function of depth. That way we cover our bases. And the first person to do that was, well, maybe 1962. And so the next person that came along said, well, that seemed to work, I'll write the equation that way too. And a pattern grew. One person does it, so the next one does, and the next one does. And we've kind of got away with writing out these equations as functions of depth, because it sort of worked. The problem with that is it's not specific about temperature. So it only works as long as the ocean stays constant. Once warming starts to occur, as we see now, then you've got to backtrack and say, whoa, we're writing these equations wrongly. Let's put them formally in terms of temperature, which I did. And we kind of got away with it because, well, temperature goes exponentially down with depth. The real equations that we should be using, the Arrhenius equations, are also exponential functions of temperature. So it kind of looks almost right, but it's not. So I had to go back and look at what the original people did in the 1950s and the 1960s and do some detective work. Well, why did they write it that way? How do we change it? And once I'd gone through that analysis, it was pretty plain that because it was done one way back in, I think, 1962, everyone has gone along on the same track. It's time to rewrite things more professionally. We can't get away with shortcuts any longer, and that's what we did.
So we have to change science now that climate change has arrived.
Well, I think the rest of the world would think that's pretty old hat science. It's just that oceanographers have been a little bit lazy in the way we've dealt with it so far. And because the equations were about right, we could sort of get away with it. Those days are gone. And so by writing it out correctly in terms of the fundamental processes, all the data starts to fall in line rather beautifully. I must say that I'm lucky in that I was able to use other people's data. Some colleagues of mine at Woods Hole had written a beautiful paper on measuring oxygen consumption rates at a place off Bermuda, and I used their data. And in a second paper I've written for the Royal Society meeting, I've scanned the world, and I'm using data from colleagues in Germany, measurements on the Red Sea, measurements in the Southern Pacific. We pulled them all together, and I enormously respect the hard work that went into people getting those numbers. Just rewrote them in terms of more basic science. And once you do that, you can see rather plainly that the ocean behaves rather well. We know the energy involved in creating organic matter, and we know what's called the activation energy for how much work it takes to get over the energy barrier to consume it, and things fall out rather beautifully. So given that, we can now say, okay, here's the chemical side of the equation, and it contributes this much. My colleagues in physics, like John Shepherd, will look at the stratification problem. And if you put a team together like this, we can make some large advances. But I think all of us are convinced it doesn't look very good.
You know, for me, one of the stunning factors is the time gap between mixing at the great depths and at the surface of the sea, where that's where the public interacts with the sea. We see this flat surface. We don't realize that it goes as deep as the highest mountains on land. So is it fair to say that the very bottom of the ocean is almost in a different age still, not yet part of the Anthropocene?
Well, it'll be true, yes. Some very good work on measuring minute changes at the very bottom of the ocean have shown that it does change. We got our first glimpse back in the 1970s when people began to map the distribution of radiocarbon from the bomb tests, and we could see it was penetrating deep into the sea. And today, if we look at the temperature structure of the ocean, you can see the global warming signal of the modern era penetrating down hundreds of meters. So in the depth regions that I've been discussing here, where there's already very low oxygen, have already been touched by modern-day warming. So yeah, the very deep waters of the ocean, thousands of meters deep, are going to be very slow to change. But there's going to be big changes, much shallower, just a few hundred meters, and that's where most of the marine life is, and it's where most of the concern is.
And I think we have, as a public who are somewhat informed about climate change, a picture of how hot it is now and how hot it could get if we get a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But we don't have that picture for the oceans. I mean, what is the general temperature of the ocean now, and how hot do scientists expect it would get, say, on the worst-case scenarios?
Well, of course, the ocean and the atmosphere are well coupled. The atmosphere is warming well. The Arctic Ocean is warming. The semi-enclosed seas, like the Baltic and the Mediterranean, are warming fastest. Yeah, we can easily see 2 degrees Celsius warming, and probably more than that if we look at the real projections from the climate change plans. And so the ocean will eventually catch up to that. The surface water keeps track rather well. The upper few hundred meters lags within a few decades. So yeah, but people in their lifetime today, or young people in their lifetime today, will experience these changes. They're readily measurable. Any young scientist who comes to my lab learns our lessons and goes on ships with us and makes observations is fully embedded in this. Animals are tied to their specific ocean environment. Temperature is a great driver. And we will see marine populations be forced to move to try and adapt to their new surroundings. In general, animals are moving polewards in the ocean, in the northern hemisphere to the North Pole and the southern hemisphere to the South Pole. We're seeing coralline species move, all kinds of species, and they're on the march.
I think we'll be joining them.
Well, I hope not.
Well, it's nice in California now. Well, look, I realize it's still early days for this whole problem of marine deoxygenation, but for the sake of our poor listeners, is it time to be concerned about oxygen loss now, or is it just time to figure out the next research priorities?
Well, of course, the average person will not experience it. The atmosphere will be warm and fully oxygenated will be the same. But yeah, I did some research up off Vancouver Island, and we were down on the seafloor measuring some methane hydrates that were exposed there, and there was some nice big black fish swimming around, a couple of feet long. And so I looked at them, and I was told by my colleagues that there is a commercial fisheries there. Those fish will be gone under 2 degree warming. The oxygen level is already fairly low, they're at their limit. And so I would say within the lifetime of a young person today, you know, fish that used to be caught off your part of the world will have to move. And so, yeah, your diet will be just changed. But it's a loss of carrying capacity of the ocean for the higher forms of life. The microbes will love it. The fish won't.
Is there anything I've missed or a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think patience and respect for people who try and disentangle this mess. I'm somewhat embarrassed when I sat down and realized my colleagues had been writing out the equations probably not in the best way for about 50 years. It's rather alarming. What other mistakes have we made? So at each step along the way, we look at a problem, we try and solve it, we fix it, and we hope to communicate the ideas as best we can. But if I look at ocean acidification and this problem, the two of them together are a far bigger hit on life in the oceans than was ever dreamed of, say, 20 years ago. And that's what's worrisome.
And that's only 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. When the first IPCC reports came out, you look back at what was said, and it's mild.
We've been speaking with a leading ocean scientist, Dr. Peter G. Brewer. He spent decades investigating the sea in some of America's top oceanographic institutes. He's now with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in California. He's helping to organize the upcoming Royal Society meeting on ocean ventilation and deoxygenation in a warming world. You can find links to that, our guest's work, in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Peter Brewer, thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Oh, thank you all.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.